the worsening impact of the opioid epidemic. This morning, the local medical examiner's office and JFRD speak out. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, make sure to catch our podcast, subscribe on iTunes, or just listen through the WJCT app. We're also live streaming audio this morning on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Like that page and listen every day. Just ahead, why this area's opioid epidemic is really impacting the local medical examiner's office. Get on the line now. 549-2937. Then later, PBS Nova documents an incredible story of a Holocaust escape during World War II. We'll speak with a survivor who's interviewed in this film and is based here in Florida. We've also got some ideas for your weekend and a ticket giveaway you won't want to miss, all of that ahead. But first this hour, a look at the opioid epidemic and its worsening impact here on the First Coast. The growing number of overdoses from opioid abuse, whether they are from prescription or illegal drugs, is causing problems at the local medical examiner's office. The ME, of course, performs autopsies. Jacksonville Fire and Rescue is also seeing the impact in their work. This morning, we're continuing our WJCT community thread discussion of the opioid epidemic and its many impacts as we welcome medical examiner Dr. Valerie Rao. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning.
Also with us, Lieutenant Mark Rowley. He's Quality Improvement Officer with the Jacksonville Fire and Rescue Department. Lieutenant, thanks for being here.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. As we talk about the tragedy and the impact of the opioid epidemic, both here locally and all over the country, what are your questions for JFRD and the medical examiner, Dr. Valerie Rao? They have a lot of information they want to share. Get on the line now, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go to Twitter, send your tweets to Melissa and Jax, emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or just weigh in on our Facebook page where we're streaming this audio live right now. Dr. Rao, let's begin with you. You have turned the medical examiner's office around in recent years after some problems that were happening there, including getting accreditation and other positive changes. So that's the good news. So kudos to you on that front. But you also have some other news you want to share, and this relates in particular to the opioid crisis in this country. How is this affecting your office?
Okay, so thank you for the positive reinforcement for my office. We have faced this opioid tragedy that has befallen the country and, of course, my office. We have done so many cases, and these are young people dying, unawares of what they are buying on the street. This year we've had, not this year, last year, 544 opioid deaths, to include Duval County, Hamilton, Columbia, Clay, Nassau. So Duval County alone, we've had in the year 2016, 451 overdose cases, of which 284 are males and 167 females. Mm-hmm. We have never seen this impact on our office. We have no space. We have to tell the hospitals and the funeral homes to keep the bodies because we have no trays. And only when we have released some bodies, then the bodies can come in for the autopsy.
You literally cannot process the bodies that are coming in to be autopsied.
Yes. We can come in on a Monday and have 9 overdoses.
So this is, in your career, in your experience, you've never seen anything like this?
Never seen something like this, ever. It's every day we go in, there are drug overdoses for sure. And these are young people, 16, 18, 21, 20. We've never seen the impact on our young folks. It's really a tragedy. And we have families calling us, crying on the phone, and we have no answers. We have no answers.
Lieutenant Mark Rowley, JFRD, this is such, the scope of this tragedy, it has impacted the entire country. It's so horrible. And these are, as the doctor said, young people who are getting hooked on opioids. Often they start with prescription medication and then move to illegal drugs. How is the fire and rescue department seeing this around town? And what are your experiences?
So the fire rescue department has seen more the number of overdose responses have more than quadrupled in 2016, just in the past two-year period between 2014 and 16. Last year alone, we responded to just over 3,000 overdose patients. If this trend continues for 2017, the city needs to be prepared as a department to respond to over 4,500 overdose patients. The amount of Narcan that our paramedics are giving to save lives has gone up nearly 400% just in the past 2 years.
Narcan is what Fire and Rescue gives someone who's in the throes of overdosing. It stops the medication from killing the person,
yes,
right? Or,
yes.
Or the drugs.
It blocks the opioid receptors,
yeah,
so that we can get the patient breathing.
Well, we recently did a television town hall on the opioid crisis right here at WJCT with a studio audience, and such incredible emotional testimony from families, from physicians, from people that work with addiction counselors. Clearly, what we're doing is not working. In both of your views, what policies need to change, and in the way that we respond to this and in the way that we treat those who are addicted? Because it's my understanding that certain medications that have been helpful in helping wean those who are addicted are not as easy to obtain. Dr. Rao, what about that?
Okay, so when you go out in the street to buy a drug, you think you're getting heroin. You are not getting heroin. You're getting fentanyl and the analogs of fentanyl. And just to give you what the particular drug, one of them, it's referred to as carfentanil. And this is a DEA-scheduled 2-opioid analgesic used to immobilize large animals. I mean, we are not large animals. It's not approved for human use. And it is 10,000 times more potent than morphine, 100 times more potent than fentanyl. So it is in the illicit drug market. And we have to tell our folks out here, don't buy anything that you have not produced yourself, because what you are buying is not what you think you're getting. Mm-hmm. So I think if that message goes out to the young people, you're not a chemist. You don't know what you're buying. Please,
sure,
don't do it.
And after Prince died, we learned that he was hooked on fentanyl, which is extremely dangerous and potent. So, Lieutenant, we know that what's on the street and what people are ingesting, it can easily kill them. What are your thoughts about the better way to respond to this crisis? Addicts have told us here in our newsroom how difficult it is to find effective treatments, that our laws and our regulations currently as they're set up make it difficult to obtain more experimental ways of weaning themselves off opioids.
Yes. From a fire department perspective, with what Dr. Rao said about carfentanil and fentanyl and these synthetic analogs of opium, we are finding that our paramedics are having to administer 2 to 3 times the dose of Narcan just to get the patient breathing. And unfortunately, in many cases, it's not successful.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, again, proving that what an addict may be taking simply is unknown. And it's truly, a lack of a better word, a suicide cocktail when somebody is taking something. And as far as how to address it, there are many people that are asking that question. Is it an issue of law enforcement to decrease the supply? Is it the need for parents and friends and families to love somebody enough to offend them? You know, to say, hey, I'm concerned about you. Is it on us as fire rescue personnel to question our stigma, and public safety officials to question the stigma, to separate the disease from the addiction, or to separate the disease from the stigma?
Dr. Rao, you're nodding.
Yes. So
what do you think?
It's so true. It's so true. You can't blame a parent, because once you're a grown adult, you make decisions. But I think parents need to step in and, you know, make a positive impact in that child. Child can be 25, 26. You're still, you know, your parents, your child. You can give that advice.
And the deaths you're seeing in the medical examiner's office are overwhelmingly young people.
Yes.
Not
yes.
Older Americans.
No. The other day we had a double drug overdose death lying in bed, a man and a woman in Clay County. two people, you know, you think it's a double homicide, but no, it's a double drug overdose.
Police in, I think it was Ohio or another state near there, they published this unbelievable photo recently that they took of a couple who had overdosed in their car and were lying dead in their car. And a young, their child, who was 4 years old, the little boy, was seen in his child safety seat in the back seat, just sitting there because his parents had literally died right there in the car, overdosed on opioids.
We are seeing an increase in responses to motor vehicle accidents where the driver is impaired on a narcotic.
All right. We have a lot of calls as we speak with medical examiner Dr. Valerie Rao and Lieutenant Mark Rowley with JFRD. We're going to start. And by the way, the number to join us is 549-2937. Chuck is out at the beaches. Hey, Chuck, good morning.
Good morning. I have personally dealt with this for about 10 years. And I will tell you that it is a disease, and it is usually dual diagnosed. It comes with mental issues, et cetera, whether it be ADHD, all kinds of other issues, depression, bipolar disease, et cetera. And the things you can do, people who have it, they go in rehab several times, they get out, and my son was doing pretty well. He had a great job. He was one of the top sales. But what happens is, and you can look at this forever, people relapse. And when they relapse, and my son relapsed, and he died from fentanyl, and this was about 350 days ago. But let me tell you what my frustration is. This is my frustration. I think 25,000 people died last year from overdoses in the United States of America. That's 100,000 mothers and fathers. That's 200,000 grandparents, brothers and sisters, and if you don't know anybody that's dealing with this, it's hard for me to imagine, because the people that you work with are dealing with it. It is everywhere. And my frustration is that under the Republican administration and the Democrat administration, I listen constantly. I haven't heard one word about this from the federal government, the news, Trump, Obama, zero, nada, nothing. When you have 25,000 people every year dying from this, number one cause of unintentional death in America, and we're not dealing with it. And this is my question. In 2003, Portugal attacked this problem. Portugal still has addicts, but they don't have deaths because they treat it like a disease. So my question to your, to you, Melissa, you need to look this up, and to your caller and to your guest, what are they doing in Portugal? Is it working? And can we do something similar to that? Thank you.
Yeah, Chuck, thank you so much. Dr. Rao, what about that? The way we're treating addiction clearly isn't working. What could we be doing differently? And let me ask you also as a follow-up. We talked about this in our recent town hall on opioids. The medication buprenorphine is, according to experts in opioid addiction, the most successful treatment for addicts. However, primary care physicians have to get a waiver from the DEA to prescribe it, and the number of primary care doctors with the certification to do that is low. So this treatment that would help addicts treat their disease is not widely available. What about Chuck's point of view, and what about the underuse of, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, buprenorphine?
Yes, buprenorphine, yes.
Buprenorphine.
Unfortunately, even that drug is used as a drug of abuse. So, you know, you really don't know how to...
So you don't think that's a panacea for this at all?
No, I don't, because people have overdosed on that particular drug also. Now, just to tell you about our local government, I know that Councilman Gulliford is passionate about this particular subject, and he has asked for all our statistics, and I know that he's been in contact with JFRD just to try to figure out how can we solve this problem. And I think it is something that the entire community has to come together to decide how are we going to approach this and deal with this.
So you both, it sounds as though you're in favor of a community-wide task force. This is a public health crisis for this community.
It is.
And I think in the way that you talk about how what you're seeing in your daily jobs is so incredibly dramatic. I just don't think until now the general public might have realized. So when you go into your office every day, the medical examiner's office, is this so extreme that you're just that your office's general workflow is unable to continue as it needs to?
Yes, the office does not have storage space, and so that's one of the issues we are facing with this inundation of cases that we are seeing in the year 2016, and it's continuing into 2017. So something has to be done. Yeah.
And for JFRD, Lieutenant, there are so many calls JFRD has to go out on. If this is taking up the bulk of your officer's time, that also means that other folks maybe who are having a heart attack or in a car accident, your office sounds as though it's really stretched to the limit by this.
Yes, ma'am. Last year alone, we had nearly a 18% increase in our EMS calls. We responded to almost 124,000 911 calls and responded almost 320,000 rescues and fire engines across the city. And that doesn't include this increase in opioids. 5 months ago, I would have told you that our paramedics were administering Narcan to save the life of an overdose victim on average every 6 hours. During our show this morning, our paramedics will be administering it on an average every 2 hours.
Let's go to Don now on the south side. Hi, Don. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Good conversation.
Thanks.
I'm an ex-junkie. During the late 60s, and I kicked in 72. The street drug was usually about 8%. So, you know, if you had a five bag a day habit, that's $50. All of a sudden, China White shows up on the street, and junkies all over the country were just dropping. And a friend of mine died. She didn't even get the entire dose into her. And this is not a new problem. Back then, the big problem was you couldn't go to a methadone maintenance treatment center without getting tagged by the police. And so I cold turkeyed it, which was horrible, and I don't recommend that to anybody. But what kind of treatments are there available today that can help people wean themselves from this?
Sure. Thanks for that question, Don. Dr. Rao.
Unfortunately, I really don't treat patients,
right.
So I really don't know what the up-to-date...
But the medications doctors use at addiction recovery centers to try to wean people off opioids, there's a very high rate of abusing again.
That's correct.
That's why you keep seeing this problem, right?
That's correct.
The treatments available are not so effective.
Yes, and the one thing that I have learned is that each treatment needs to be individualized to the patient. And there are ongoing studies with Suboxone injectables and implants for sustained medication-assisted treatment.
Calvin in Arlington is on the line with some thoughts about treatment. Hey, Calvin, thanks for calling.
As an emergency physician, there was a study that came out in late 2015 about chronic pain management. It was a study of over 33,000 patients, and one in 550 people who are on pain management by a pain management professional die of overdose of opiates. And this is a little bit of a collision course between the business of medicine and patient satisfaction scores. An administration pushing physicians to do their best to please people, and physicians being overrun by volume. And the easiest thing to do is, well, instead of counseling people that pain is a real phenomenon in life, that no matter what we can, the advances of modern medicine, I can't take all the pain away, and living with pain is part of the unfortunate reality of the human existence. And these collision courses of American culture and business culture and potent medicines that are so addictive, this is the result of them.
Yes, Calvin, and that is so right. Thank you so much for calling and pointing that out. He's right. You know, that is really at the heart of a lot of this.
Yes, Melissa, I have the opportunity to also work as a ER nurse at the busiest emergency room in Jacksonville Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of physicians have been taught that the fifth vital sign is pain. And while pain management is so important to patient care and treatment, there is a ongoing discussion about eliminating that fifth vital sign of pain and or tying it to patient satisfaction surveys, which ultimately also ties to reimbursement for the hospital.
Right. Okay, lots of calls. And if you're just tuning in, as we're speaking with medical examiner Dr. Valerie Rao and Lieutenant Mark Riley with JFRD, we are looking at a crisis situation these medical professionals want to share with all of our listeners when it comes to the opioid epidemic right here on the First Coast. Gabriel on the South Side is with us. Hey, Gabriel, thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Melissa. Love your show.
Thank you.
The one thing I've noticed, I'm a cardiologist, and I've worked at the hospitals in the past, and now in my practice, every single day I see patients coming in, elderly patients you wouldn't expect to be hooked on narcotics, but they come in with basically polypharmacy. Like yesterday, I had a patient who was on pain pills, Norco and fentanyl. Those are just two pain pills. And also in a sleeping pill like Ambien, and also two had Xanax for anxiety. So we have patients coming in with all these multiple medications that actually hurt them. And so that's a big problem that we're having,
mm-hmm.
Not only just the pain pills, the prescription pain pills. And I've gotten to a point now where I refuse to prescribe any controlled substances. And unfortunately, just basically to protect the patient. And I don't think in 2016 I prescribed anything controlled because I just do electronic prescriptions.
Yeah.
But some of the problems, physicians were caught in the front line, and especially the primary care physicians. And I think some of it has to do with marketing, as was brought down by the physician, the ER physician that mentioned correctly how pain is a fifth a vital sign, of which is not, but we are being pressured to treat pain in patients. And then also, too, one other thing we have to realize is the only two countries in the world that market drugs directly to consumers, and that's the United States and New Zealand. There are consequences when you peddle drugs directly to consumers in pain. The pain epidemic is just one of those problems that we find, and we are caught in the front line, and it seems like physicians are the problem, but I think there are forces beyond our profession, and we need help from everybody.
Thanks, Gabriel. Another doctor calling in. And you hear this all the time from physicians, Dr. Rao. They just don't want to even get into the weeds of prescribing these substances because they are so concerned about the potential for addiction, even if the patient is legitimately in pain.
Yes, so let me address that. So when we get calls from families that have lost a loved one and who is on these pain medications, they immediately blame the doctor and they want to sue the doctor. And I always tell them, the doctor cannot go home with you and watch how you take your medication. They can give you the prescription, but how the patient takes it, that is up to the patient, and you cannot blame the doctor and then want to sue the doctor because they are trying their best to alleviate your pain. So, the doctor is caught between the patient and then the question of overdosing. So I can understand the mm-hmm. physician's point of view, yes.
Brooks is in Orange Park. Hey, Brooks, go ahead.
Hi, Melissa. I'm just elated that you were bringing this to the forefront of conversation today. Thank you.
Sure.
Speaking as somebody who is in a relationship with an addict, I just want to address the difficulty it is for someone coming from Clay County to receive any type of treatment. The only treatment available is in Duval County. And for the past 7 or 8 months, I have tried to use every available option to find something closer for people around here because I have many friends that have suffered from this, and it just hurts me to see them not be able to get any type of treatment other than something in Jacksonville. And mm-hmm. when I go there with them, it's when you wait 2 or 3 hours to get Suboxone, it destroys them and it really hurts them. And, you know, that's obviously just a cause of the decisions they made, but some of the looks and things and just the psychological implications of them going to receive treatment hurt more than the fact that they, like, than anything else they're undergoing, and it makes them not want to come back.
You mean they're ashamed, they feel the stigma of this?
Yeah, yeah, and yeah. They feel the stigma of it from people at the facility sometimes, which I know every facility is different, but it's just as somebody coming from the outside helping some friends of mine, it's just hard. And I honestly don't, I don't need to take too much time here, but I just don't see any feasible option for many people suffering from this.
Brooks, I'm so sorry. I completely understand that feeling of hopelessness, I think, right now is shared by many. That's Brooks in Orange Park. So, Lieutenant Rally, people feel hopeless about this, and it is certainly a public health crisis that is destroying families and lives. We've got to try to find a way to give people hope that we can get our arms around this problem. But it's not going to be an easy one to address based on both of your testimonies.
No, stigma is a major factor preventing persons from either seeking and or completing treatment.
Dr. Rao, what can we tell folks to give them hope? Is there anything in the research in terms of how clinicians are trying to treat addiction that we need to share with our listeners that we haven't already reported?
Yeah, so this is a public health problem, and I think if the only way we can solve this is everybody putting their maximum efforts and their thoughts together to resolve this. But this is a public health issue, and mm-hmm. impacting the ME's office, impacting GFRD, and so it's such a wide impact on the entire community, and there's got to be a solution.
Here's an email from Kendra. I am a licensed acupuncture physician in Jacksonville, and this war on opioids can be partly solved by patients being encouraged by their doctors to try other methods for relieving their pain. Acupuncture has been studied extensively, and it's effective. Other methods like biofeedback, massage, and chiropractic can be effective as well. In my mind, pain meds should be a last resort. Thanks for that email, Kendra. Elizabeth in Julington Creek. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Yes, 2 points. In order for us to find a solution is to face up to exactly historically what has been done. The fact is in the 80s and 90s, we had a war on drugs. The primary target were African Americans, and our prison systems are filled with people committing drug offenses. I am heartened to see, because so much of the deaths and so much of the addiction that we're seeing today are rural white people, that we are talking about this in terms of a disease instead of labeling these people criminals and that they don't have any values, et cetera, et cetera. I think the previous caller talked about the stigma involved. Well, you know, I do think that we are in this situation because for too long we have denied, we have buried ourselves in terms of who gets addicted and who uses drugs. And unfortunately, this is where race rears its ugly head again.
Yeah, Elizabeth, that's another element of this story for sure. Doctor.
Yes, so let me address the racial numbers. So out of the 451 cases in Duval County, 247 are white, 35 are African Americans, and other, which could be Orientals, other races, but 2. The female-to-male ratio, 284 male, 167 female. That is only in Duval County in the last year, 2016. And that number is not the complete year because we still are trying to finish our toxicology. It sometimes takes time. So the actual numbers will be more accurate if you go to the FDLE site on the last day of June, where they will give you the 2016 numbers, so you'll get a very better picture. This is around the state. The governor wants all the medical examiner's offices to enter that data, so you can just go in there and see where Duval County, you know, features in this entire catastrophe that we have right now.
It is a public health catastrophe. We will have more detail about this and the information we're getting from the medical examiner's office in JFRD later today at our website, wjctnews.org. And as regular listeners know, we are doing ongoing reporting, both on radio, digital, and on television, about the opioid crisis in this community. And so medical examiner Dr. Valerie Rao and Lieutenant Mark Rowley, he's quality improvement officer with JFRD, we thank you both so much for sharing this vital information with the public. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Okay, and much more still ahead later. We've got some ideas for your weekend, including a ticket giveaway to Jekyll Island's Whiskey, Wine, and Wildlife event, so keep listening for that. But up next, the PBS show Nova and one incredible story of a Holocaust escape. Back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Goodwill of North Florida. Donate, shop, jobs. Good things for North Florida with Goodwill. Proud supporters of WJCT's First Coast Connect. GoodwillJax.org for more info.
I'm Joshua Johnson. On the next 1A, life as a federal employee. President Trump is cleaning house at federal agencies, getting rid of some workers who question his decisions. What does it mean for the nation if career government workers who dissent are considered disloyal? An inside look at government service under the Trump administration next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Classical music is available 22 hours a day on WJCT 89.9 FM HD2. Find out how you can listen to classical music by calling 358-6390. Enjoy classical music day or night on 89.9 HD2.
Welcome back. Well, 70 years ago, the Eastern European town of Vilnius was known as the Jerusalem of Lithuania, a bustling place home to more than 100,000 Jewish residents. But then it all vanished. During the 3 years of the Holocaust, 95% of Lithuanian Jews were killed. But hidden within this tragedy is a story of hope and courage that archaeologists are just now bringing to light. Cutting-edge technology is revealing an incredible Holocaust escape tunnel where survivors dug their way to freedom outside the town of Vilnius. The PBS program Nova filmed this team as they made their incredible find, and the Nova documentary features interviews with archaeologists, geophysicists, and scholars who described what happened to the Jews living near what is now Vilnius. Holocaust survivor Abe Gohl is one of the people Nova spoke to. He's down in Miami, and he's on the line now to tell us more about this incredible story. Abe, thanks for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Now, you're a second-generation Holocaust survivor, and you were interviewed for this program. Can you share with us a little bit of your story and why they chose to include you in the show?
Well, I was first-generation survivor. My father was a survivor. He was one of the architects of the tunnel, along with Mr. Dugan, who pretty much led the whole thing. And it was just a will to survive. As I was growing up, he was very reluctant to talk about it. But as I got older, I found out why, and the trustee of the whole thing, that he wanted to protect me from it. He was, before he was caught by the Germans, he joined a group of partisans around Vilna, and they had tried to fight the Germans the best they could. But when they were caught, along with 78 other prisoners, they were charged with basically uncovering all the Jews that had been shot by both the Germans and some of the Lithuanian, I guess the Lithuanians that were in complicity with the Nazis at the time. And they wanted to uncover the bodies, burn them, so there'd be no evidence or nothing left of anybody being killed over there after the war would be over.
Uh-huh.
So the Russians were advancing from the east, and you know, the Germans thought that having 100,000 bodies exhumed would eventually, you know, let the world see exactly what they did, and they didn't want that to happen. So they had these 80 people dig up the bodies, burn the bodies, remove valuables from them, and just keep going until they uncovered all 100,000. My father was telling me that they were telling all the others that if they don't escape out of there, that they'll be the next 80 to go after that. And so they hatched a plan to try to dig their way out from the bunker that they were, that was supposedly used as their, not supposedly, but was used as their living quarters at the time.
Right. Nearly 80 people dug this tunnel pretty much by hand as they tried to escape this Nazi extermination site. Researchers have used radar, radio waves to find this tunnel underneath the ground, between 5 and 9 feet below the surface. That is absolutely extraordinary.
And it's really extraordinary in the fact that what I found out from the archaeologists and the folks involved in trying to uncover that is that the ground was kind of like silty, not quite sandy, but I guess kind of like a hard pack, and eventually collapsing on itself and being very sandy, but they were still able, and you can see it in their sonar type, photographs or x-rays of the ground, that the tunnel does exist there.
And of the 80 or so who dug the tunnel, 12 managed to escape. Is that right?
Yes, 12 managed to escape before the Germans heard them coming out of that of the opening and started shooting. So they're not quite sure whether they were all shot or just captured, but the 12 managed to escape, and another one died later on during the war. So after the war, there were 11 left.
And the discovery of the tunnel is so significant because this was something that had been thought of as almost a myth. Isn't that right, Abe? Like, people had told tales of it. It was rumored. But now there's confirmation. This actually happened.
Oh, yes. Yes, there is. And, according to Dr. Richard Fern, who's the archaeologist and professor of Jewish studies at Hartford University, was involved in that. You can actually tell not just the tunnel, but some pieces of wood that were used to help shore up the tunnel, keep it from collapsing as they were digging through.
How have these revelations impacted you and your family? And of course, we're having an event here at WJCT with a screening of this program. It's actually sold out. There's so much interest to learn more about this. But participating in the program and telling your story and your family's story, what has that been like for you?
It's kind of been, I've known this all my life and lived, basically lived through it by reading some of the accounts that were written and something that, my father had written. So I knew it really exists and definitely had to be there. But now, as we have so many people around the world trying to deny that the Holocaust has ever happened, it really not just brings legitimacy and truth to it, but brings out some of the some of the heroism of people that and their will to survive and their will to go on and live.
Sure, and we're so pleased to host Dr. Richard Freund in a preview of this NOVA episode at our WJCT studios. This is coming up on February 9th. It's actually sold out. So the lucky people that are able to come will definitely be very interested in this. And of course, we'll air the program on WJCT TV later this year. On the line from Miami with us, participant in the show, Abe Gohl. We so appreciate you joining the show and sharing this with us. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
All right. And in a moment, some ideas for your weekend and a ticket giveaway to Jekyll Island's Whiskey, Wine, and Wildlife. Keep listening.
On the next Fresh Air, the Trump administration's relationship with the alt-right and the divisions Trump's created in the Christian right. We'll talk with journalist Sarah Posner, who writes about the intersection of religion and politics. In her interview with Steve Bannon last August, he described Breitbart News, which he then headed, as the platform for the alt-right. He's now the president's chief strategist. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On February 14th, the full Jacksonville City Council is expected to take up a controversial change to the city's human rights ordinance. Join WJCT for a live, interactive, televised discussion on February 8th as a panel explores the division over the expansion of Jacksonville's human rights ordinance protections for the LGBT community. Log on to wjct.org/events/community-thread to submit your questions or to RSVP to be part of our studio audience on February 8th. Community Thread, LGBT rights on the First Coast.
Today's segment with Carrie Speckman is brought to you in part by Blue Bamboo Asian Kitchen.
All right, welcome back. It's a brand new event this Saturday on Jacksonville's East Side, the Melanin Market and Parade. It's going to have everything from fresh food to health screenings and a parade. Organizers Nikki Brunson and Dana Miller are here to tell us all about it. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. The
Thank
Melanin
you.
Market and Parade. Nikki Brunson, you are a force in Springfield and the east side of Jacksonville. This is a really cool new event. What's going to be happening?
Well, the community has gotten together, and we decided that we couldn't think of any better way to celebrate Black History Month than a parade. Mm-hmm. And so we decided to organize a parade.
And this is going to go right up APR, A. Philip Randolph Boulevard,
it
correct?
It starts on 5th Street, East 5th Street on Florida Avenue, and it will progress south and then take a very quick right and left and then get back on A. Philip Randolph and end at Union Street where the market is being held.
Okay, so Dana, tell us about the market. What's going to be at the market?
Well, I know for one, my mobile barbershop will be at the market. Yes, the mobile grooming experience, and we have approximately close to 100 vendors that will be there, will be selling food, different apparel. You have people just out there entertaining, enjoying themselves, you know, just celebrating Black history and the legacy of the East Side. So we're really looking forward to people coming out and just enjoying themselves.
Let's talk about that, the history of this part of town. Nikki, A. Philip Randolph, of course. There would never have been a March on Washington if it weren't for Jacksonville's own A. Philip Randolph.
Yes, thank you for noticing. We really appreciate the efforts that this the namesake of this street. And we appreciate the legacy that goes along with our community as we rebrand ourselves. And we really take a grasp of what our vision looks like and what community stabilization looks like for us. So,
and the rebranding, part of that is calling this the Melanin Market. Tell us about that.
The Melanin Market. Well, of course, melanin, there are so many different shades of melanin, and those different shades and layers basically represent the culture of this community. We are naturally a diverse culture. We have always been a mixed-use community, and we have hosted every variation that has come into Jacksonville. We have truly anchored development in the community, and I think our revitalization is a part of an overall spark to the Jacksonville.
Yeah, so we're looking forward to it. As the African-American community, we are a large consumer. There last year on record, we spent like $1.2 trillion. So now we're trying to make a venue where we can bring those funding and that money back to our community, that we can build our community back to be the, what's it, the Black Wall Street of past. And so that's what we're doing, trying to revive the historic east side of Jacksonville to make it great again.
Very nice. And again, this is coming up Saturday morning, bright and early. It starts at 9 o'clock. A parade, a neighborhood market, health screenings, entertainment. The entire public is invited to this free event. Come on out Saturday to the Melanin Market and Parade. It kicks off at Gilbert Middle School, and it will end along A. Philip Randolph Boulevard.
Yes. That's correct.
Yes,
it will.
All right. Nikki Brunson, Dana Miller. That's so nice to hear about, and we thank you so much for coming in to tell us about it.
Thank you for having us.
Again, that's Saturday morning, and finally this hour we have a few other ideas and a ticket giveaway. From Arlo Guthrie to Whiskey, Wine, and Wildlife, we have a lot to talk about. Here she is every Thursday to take us all around town. We welcome the mistress of mayhem, the maven of mirth, thespectator.com's Carrie Speckman.
That's
here
me,
today.
Everybody. That's me.
I would so love to just have people applaud me wherever
well,
I go.
This is the only place it happens, so.
Oh, really? That's just not right.
I would like to give a shout out to Nikki and her adorable green hair.
That's right.
And Dana's snazzy jacket.
They're looking good.
And Nick, for being Nick.
Yeah. Nick Thompson, who is their friend, and he's just sort of sitting
in the
corner.
Strangely quiet. He's kind of weird.
Yeah. Unusually so, yeah. Yeah, okay.
Spooky.
All right, let's talk about this weekend, beginning with, now we talked about the Melanin Market, that's Saturday.
Yes, we did.
Now, tonight at the Florida Theater, it
Arlo
is the legendary
Guthrie.
Arlo Guthrie.
Yes, he will be there.
That's amazing.
At the Florida Theater. I mean, he comes here, I think, every year.
Oh, does he?
Perhaps
okay.
Perhaps he should get a home here.
He can live by you.
He can take advantage of the homestead exemption. I don't even know what that means. I just heard it before.
You don't know what that means?
I don't. I live in an apartment.
I know.
It's not
I know.
Important to me.
Yeah, you're a city dweller.
That's me.
But yeah, but Arlo Guthrie coming in tonight. Also tonight, Hope McMath. What is Hope McMath up to?
This is, it's called the People's State of Union Story Circle. And people are going to talk about... They're going to reflect on the community, what's going on in the world, and they're going to make art.
Yes. And there's several of these happening around town.
Yes. And then they're following it up tomorrow with a More Perfect Union, Explorations of Human Rights. And they're going to have some of the best known artists in town showing their work. And they're going to talk about Black lives, housing discrimination, gender equality, and the local fight for an inclusive human rights ordinance.
All right. This is tonight and
tomorrow
Friday
at the Space,
at the Space Gallery. Okay. Yes. Let's mention a few more of your items, and then I got to do the ticket giveaway. Universal Circus is here for Sunday.
Universal Circus.
That's how that's like coming to America.
That's how they say
it. Let your soul glow. Remember that?
Wow.
Whenever I think of that movie, that's all I
Michelle
can think of.
Is cracking up in there. No, that's what they say.
That is all I can think of
that's
when I think
they
of
say
coming
on the radio,
to America.
Universal Circus. But apparently it's been called one of the top three circuses along with Ringling Brothers, Womp Womp, and Cirque du Soleil.
Now, Universal Circus may...
Soul Circus!
They still use animals, too, so they will probably see some protests.
And it's in an actual big tent,
yeah.
Which is... circus, and it's across from the Prime Osborne. It's in one of those parking lots.
Yeah.
You can't miss it.
Okay. So that's coming for the love of food trucks at Unity Plaza.
Yes. That is Saturday, and it's a free Valentine's-themed event. They'll have food trucks, beer and wine, and dog adoptions, craft vendors,
oh, nice. Okay.
Kids Zone, and the World of Willy Wonka. I'm not really sure what that is.
We don't know what that is, but it sounds interesting.
And it's free. Again, it's free. Unity Plaza.
What is the Magic Mike live tour?
Well, if I had to explain to you about Magic Mike.
No, you do not.
Actually, it's
I know
a
all about it.
It's a tribute.
It's a tribute
not
act.
Actual
okay.
Channing
not the
Tatum Dang. There. I know.
Ah.
So it's basically, you know, guys and
okay.
baby oil.
Saturday night at the Landing.
At Mavericks. Specifically. Yes.
Okay. All right. So you got a full list here. Go to thespectator.com. We didn't get every single one mentioned.
It happens.
Because we have right now a very special treat.
Ooh.
Three pairs of tickets to give away to Whiskey, Wine, and Wildlife.
Ooh.
That is a big event coming up next Saturday on Jekyll Island. This is a culinary event. Breathtaking oceanfront experiences with legendary beverages and culinary tastings. The perfect wintertime escape to Jekyll Island. These tickets are worth $65
Ooh.
Each. You're going to get to do all kinds of stuff. Incredible drinks and food and entertainment at that Jekyll Island Historic Village. All around the new Westin Hotel there. We have three pairs of tickets.
That's six, according to my calculations.
Email the show right now, and we will pick three winners at random. The unimpeachable Kevin Mershart
I knew that was coming.
Will make the picks. Email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org to get your pair of tickets to Whiskey,
That's
Wine,
two.
And Wildlife.
Pair. That's two.
I wish I could go. It's going to be fun. That's
Why can't
be,
you go? You're a busy lady.
I'll be doing mom stuff. You know how that goes.
No, I don't, actually. Cat mom stuff.
Go to thespectator.com and check out weekend events. And thanks for being here so much.
You know what? It's been a pleasure
and an inconvenience. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. 1A's up next. What does it mean for the nation of career government workers who dissent are considered disloyal? That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be back again tomorrow at 9 with our media roundtable. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.